This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Dr. Elizabeth Gray, Director of Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Washington and co-author of the article Biofuels and Biodiversity, Principles for Creating Better Policies for Biofuel Production, published in the February 2008 edition of Conservation Biology. Elizabeth Gray is here today to tell us about the environmental footprint of biofuels and to recommend principles for developing biofuels that are environmentally sound. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
Would you remind us of the potential advantages of using biofuels?
Sure. In 2005, the United States passed a legislative measure asking for renewable fuel standards of using 7.5 billion gallons of biofuels by 2012. And so we are looking for ways to reduce our reliance on oil-based petroleum fuels, as well as looking for ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And this is where biofuels appear very promising.
What led you to try to determine the ecological footprint of biofuels?
Well, as you know, Seattle is a very green city, and our citizens are very environmentally aware. And about a couple of years ago, there was a strong push in the state to promote legislation supporting biofuels. And at that point, much of the environmental community was very supportive of using biofuels as a way for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It was clear that people wanted to do the right thing. However, it seemed to me that what we were missing was the information knowing exactly what that right thing was. And so what we were missing was information to answer questions such as what is the environmental footprint of producing these particular biofuels, as well as information looking at the net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions based on particular fuels. And so what I did was teamed up with one of my colleagues, Dr. Martha Groom at the University of Washington, and one of her graduate students, Patricia Townsend. And we started to investigate answers to the questions such as what is the environmental footprint and how do you reduce greenhouse gas emissions with these particular biofuels? And that was the impetus for the study that we conducted.
Would you remind us of the biofuels that are currently being used commercially?
Sure. So there are two different ways that you can produce biofuels. There's bioethanol, and that is produced using either starches, which are corn and wheat, or sugar, such as sugarcane. And then you can have cellulosic ethanol produced with things such as woody biomass, tree residues, and residues from crops. And then there are your biodiesels. These are fuels that are produced by stocks such as oils, soybean oil and canola oil, as well as microalgae.
And which of these are ones you can actually go out and buy right now?
Well, over 90% of the production of biofuels in the United States is produced by corn ethanol, although we're also importing oils made from oil palms and soybeans and canola oil as well.
In your study, how did you go about determining the ecological footprint of biofuels? Which factors did you take under consideration?
What we were looking at was the complete production life cycle of these biofuels. So we considered things such as energy inputs. We were looking at how much water is used to produce these biofuels, how many pesticides and fertilizers are used to grow them, how much energy is used. And then we also looked at whether or not land was cleared, native habitat was cleared, or whether they were perhaps being grown on degraded lands.
Could you say more about the importance of doing a life cycle analysis?
Sure. When we first started our study, what we realized is that it was really difficult to compare the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions between these different fuels. And that's because many of the studies looked at one component of the life cycle, but not the entire production life cycle. So what you really need to look at is how are these fuels grown, then how are they harvested, how are they transported to the refineries, how are they refined, and then how much greenhouse gas emissions are burned. And so that is what we mean by the entire production life cycle, from literally planting the plant to harvesting it to then refining it and then burning it.
What are some of the challenges in doing an accurate analysis of the environmental footprint of biofuels? What are some of the uncertainties?
Well, one of the big challenges is that we really don't have information on many of these biofuels. We need many, many more studies that are done looking at the different components of how much energy is used to produce them and to harvest them and refine them, as well as when they are burned. So one of the big challenges that we found is that there's a lack of information. So when you look at our studies, there's a lot of information, for example, on corn ethanol, and very little on new promising technologies such as microalgae. So one of the challenges is we just need more information to be able to calculate the entire production life cycle of these fuels.
Could you underscore the biofuels that you chose to evaluate?
Sure. So we looked at biofuels produced by corn, by soybean, by sugarcane, by oil palm, as well as fuels using native prairie grasses, switchgrasses, woody biomass, residues, and microalgae.
How do the biofuels you evaluated compare in regard to greenhouse gas emissions?
Oh, that's a great question. They compare quite radically. So, for example, if you look at corn and oil palm, the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions is fairly equivalent to what we currently have with petroleum today. Where you really get the greatest benefits is with native prairie grasses, switchgrasses, and microalgae. That is where you will actually see either a net sequestration of greenhouse gases or an actual decrease in the amount of greenhouse gas emissions when you look across the entire production life cycle. And then there are some other ones that really depend on how they are produced. So woody biomass, for example, cellulosic ethanol, that depends on the production methods that are used, whether or not you get a net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions.
Which biofuels are most efficient in terms of energy output to fossil energy input?
Our results suggest that microalgae is by far the most promising in terms of energy inputs to energy outputs. And the other benefit to microalgae is that it also has a very small land area requirement for producing it.
And which ones are the worst in that regard?
So our results also showed that corn ethanol is by far the worst in terms of both requiring a huge land mass for production, as well as not having a positive benefit in reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. And so here's an analogy I can give you. To produce enough fuel to meet one half of our ground transportation needs in the United States, you would need to grow corn over 1 million square miles. This is an area that would cover the continent of India. By contrast, if we were to produce the same amount of fuel from microalgae, we would need just roughly 6 to 12,000 square miles of land, or a land base the area of Vermont.
How do the various biofuels you studied compare in regard to water use?
That's another great question. By far, the worst contenders, again, are our corn and our sugarcane, our soy and our canola and our oil palm. The ones that rely on the least amount of water necessary to produce are the switchgrasses and the native prairie grasses.
Let's go back and say more about the type of land that's needed for feedstocks for different biofuels. Could you say more about that and what the implications are?
Sure. So the amount of land needed to produce a biofuel was one of our greatest considerations in terms of thinking about whether you could produce sustainable biofuels. And so what we looked at is, again, the amount of land needed to meet one half of the U.S. ground transportation needs. And what we found was that native prairie grasses and corn and soybean actually have a large land requirement. In fact, corn, as I mentioned, we don't have enough land mass in the United States if we were to convert all of our land to corn production to actually meet one half of our transportation needs. Whereas in contrast, other fuel sources, again, going back to microalgae, would require just 1.1% of our agricultural lands, or about 2.5% of our total land base, to actually meet one half of the U.S. demand for ground transportation.
And are there issues in terms of the types of land that would be likely to be used for the different crops?
That's a great question. So what we recommend in terms of the results of what we found in our study is that we do not destroy any intact native habitat to produce biofuels. And in addition, we would recommend that we do not use any land that is currently being used for food, for current agriculture. Rather, there are lots of ways, for example, to grow woody biomass on lands that are degraded so that you can actually have the benefits of restoration of these lands as well as producing biofuel stocks. You can also do this with the native prairie grasses and the switchgrasses. So you can look for degraded lands that are actually in need of restoration and meet both ecological and economic needs at the same time.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Gray, Director of Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Washington. Our topic is the environmental footprint of biofuels and principles for developing biofuels that are environmentally sound. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How do biofuels compare in regard to their likely effects on biodiversity and natural habitats?
Again, it depends on which biofuel you are actually considering. Some biofuels can have a negative impact on biodiversity. So, for example, if you grow these fuels in monocultures over large areas of land, such as what we're currently doing with corn, there are also implications, for example, of clearing, again, native habitats. So, for example, in Brazil, we are clearing native forest for plantations, and then those plantations are being converted into sugarcane plantations for biofuels. And so those impacts have a negative impact on biodiversity. In contrast, there have been recent studies showing, for example, that using native prairie grasses for biofuel production can actually enhance biodiversity. So by planting these native prairie grasses, we can actually provide habitat for wild animals, for wild birds. We can increase habitat for pollinators, which are becoming extinct or decreasing in population throughout the United States. You can provide additional habitat for them. So again, different fuels will have different impacts on biodiversity, some more positive and some more negative.
To what extent might the crops used to produce biofuels pose a danger in terms of becoming invasive species?
I'm glad you asked that question. That's another question that we were concerned with and that we did look at in our study. And so there is potential for many of these fuel stocks, if they are planted in areas where they are not native, to become invasive. And so one of the recommendations that we make in our paper is for policymakers to promote legislation that prevents biofuels being grown in places where they can become invasive. That is a concern that is on the radar screen of many people who are looking at this issue today.
So how would you summarize the most negative aspects of growing biofuels?
Today, the primary emphasis on production of biofuels is on what we call land and water-hungry biofuel stocks. And it's because most of the decisions to date have been driven by economic and political factors rather than looking at the ecology and the biodiversity factors. And so the potential negative consequences of growing biofuels in an unsustainable manner are, first of all, conversion of native habitat. So, for example, in the United States, looking at the USDA's CRP, or Conservation Reserve Program, there is discussion of taking these conservation lands out of conservation to grow corn for ethanol. So that would be a potential negative impact in terms of native systems, as well as, for example, palm oil plantations in Malaysia, or negative impacts worldwide on threatened and endangered species. So this conversion of native ecosystems. You also have impacts on water quality and water quantity because of the heavy water usage that is used in producing many of these biofuels. They have pollution issues with the amount of fertilizer and pesticides that are used to produce many of these fuels, especially corn is one of the worst offenders. We also have the invasive species as biofuel stocks. And then there's issues of soil erosion. In many of the issues of using crop residues, if you take these residues out of the agricultural lands, you may actually increase the likelihood of erosion rather than leaving them on the ground to prevent erosion. So that's another issue that one wants to think about when looking at harvesting methods and production methods. And then finally, the climate impacts for cultivating, transporting, refining, and then ultimately burning these fuels. So those would be the potential negative consequences that we want to keep in mind when thinking about developing solid policy recommendations for how to promote sustainable biofuels in the future.
Well, you've already been alluding to this, but looking at all your different criteria together, which biofuels are the least ecologically sound?
By far, corn ethanol is the least ecologically sound biofuel, and we promote, Dr. Groom and Patricia Townsend and I promote, that we move as quickly as possible away from corn ethanol as a fuel stock for biofuels and towards more fuels of the future.
And which, then, would you say is the most ecologically sound of the ones you examined?
So of the ones we examined, microalgae appears to be the most ecologically sound and promising biofuel for the future.
And then looking in between, where do the others stack up?
I would say probably the next best potential biofuels would be the native prairie grass systems and the switchgrass. And cellulosic ethanol, or ethanol that's created from woody biomass, from wood fibers, and for residues such as corn stovers and the remains of crops after you use the crops for food, that is also a very promising source for biofuels in the future as well.
Let's focus on the algae, which you say are the best. Could you say more about algae as a biofuel and its major benefits?
Sure. Well, the first thing to know is that algae is really the only real contender for mass production of biofuel on a very small spatial scale. And so, again, I mentioned that to produce enough biofuel to meet one half of our ground transportation needs, we would only need an area the size roughly of Vermont. The other nice thing about microalgae is it actually removes carbon from the atmosphere. So you get a net sequestration of greenhouse gas emissions with algae. In addition, algae can be grown in industrial sites. So you can grow algae in cities. You can grow it in degraded areas. You can actually grow it in pipes that are attached to industrial plants. So the place that it's grown can be quite beneficial because you can actually grow it near the source where it's going to be used, and again, in degraded sites and in cities, so that you're not having an impact on natural intact ecosystems.
What are the issues in terms of water use with algae?
One of the problems with algae currently is it does have a very high water usage. It takes a lot of water to produce it in a way to actually result in these biofuels. One of the potential solutions for this is that people are looking at, currently a lot of algae are grown for pharmaceutical uses and they're grown in open ponds. And so one of the things that people are looking at and are investigating currently is growing them in what we call closed systems or in bioreactors. These are piping systems. And when you put them in these piping systems, not only do you reduce the potential ecosystem impacts, but you also greatly reduce the amount of water that is needed to move these algae stocks to biofuels.
What would you say that the key drawbacks of algae are in terms of our current knowledge?
In terms of our current knowledge, one of the challenges with algae is we have an enormous number of plankton species of diatoms and algae and a cyanobacteria, and all of these produce a huge number of compounds. And so one of the challenges that people have is to try to figure out how do you get these algae, these phytoplankton, these diatoms to actually produce fuel precursors rather than other products. And so this is one of the challenges, one of the technical challenges that companies and R&D efforts are investigating currently.
Are there additional technical challenges to bringing algae forward as a biofuel?
I would say in terms of growing it, the issues that I just mentioned are probably the most pressing. And again, I'm not an expert on microalgae. However, I will say that based on the results of our study, it does certainly seem like the most promising biofuel or fuel stock for the future.
What principles should we use in helping to choose the most ecologically sound biofuel? Because there may be additional ones coming forward.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's a great question again. So first of all, we would say promote those biofuels that have the lowest impacts. So require the least amount of water, require the least amount of fertilizers and chemicals when you're actually growing these. Also look for fuels that you can use to protect the soil that don't have negative impacts to soil. So for example, the native prairie grasses and the switchgrasses, where you can actually reduce erosion, promote biodiversity of native species at the same time. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, look at those biofuels that actually have a net reduction or at least a zero balance in terms of greenhouse gas emissions when you look at the entire production life cycle.
Could you expand on the type of agricultural practices that would be best to use in producing biofuels?
Sure. So we would recommend that one thinks about producing biofuels in what we call polycultures. So this is growing different species together rather than looking at monocultures of annual crops. So polycultures of perennial species, species that live year after year. And this is because they tend to store carbon underground, which is beneficial, obviously, to taking carbon out of the atmosphere. The second thing you would want to look at is, again, native habitat, if these biofuels can create native habitat for species. And then, again, lower levels of inputs to actually growing and harvesting these biofuels.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dr. Elizabeth Gray. Director of Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Washington. Our topic is the environmental footprint of biofuels and principles for developing biofuels that are environmentally sound. What is your evaluation of our current policies for biofuels, both at the national level and state level as well?
Well, first, we really applaud the fact that the state and that the United States in general is thinking about creative ways to reduce our reliance on oil and to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But what we would recommend is that, first of all, we establish a national policy for biofuels that minimizes a risk both to biodiversity and to our climate. In addition, we recommend in our paper that we look for certification standards or develop a certification method so that we can certify biofuels that were processed throughout their entire production life cycle in a way that is sustainable. And we still have a ways to go. There are conversations that are ongoing right now in terms of looking at the potential to develop certification standards, but that is something that hasn't quite happened yet, so people are just in discussion at the moment.
So in terms of the certification system, what kinds of things are under discussion?
Well, many of the issues are issues that we've touched on in today's interview. First of all, looking at the fact of whether we would actually be willing to use crops that, for example, were produced if native habitat was cleared, for example, in Malaysia or in Brazil or even in the United States. So looking at whether native habitat was used. Another criteria could potentially be looking at the invasive species issue. So were these fuel stocks grown in areas where they have the potential or they have already become invasive? Another question would be, are these fuel stocks being grown in areas where there's high biodiversity? And so, for example, there may be potential for people to identify areas of high biodiversity, and fuel stocks should be then grown outside of these areas. So these are the types of issues and criteria that people are considering in terms of a certification standard, and that is currently under discussion.
Who's involved in developing the certification system?
Well, there are currently a couple of different groups that are involved in looking at certification. There is a group called the Council on Sustainable Biomass Production. This is primarily a U.S.-based group that is looking at certification standards. There's also a more international group, and that group is called the Roundtable on Sustainable Biofuels. And both of these groups are considering certification standards and looking at how to certify biofuels that are environmentally sound as well as economically beneficial. And the international group is also looking at the social impacts of producing biofuels and trying to wrap that into its potential certification criteria.
Is the Nature Conservancy involved in the certification talks?
We are currently involved in the certification talks, although as an organization, we are developing currently an organization-wide policy on biofuels that hasn't quite been finalized yet.
How do you see the certification system as being used?
Well, my hope would be for the future that we have a certification standard that enables us to produce bio-friendly and climate-friendly biofuels, and that that will be a system that we use so that we can guarantee that we are using fuels that are not negatively impact our environment, as well as reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And I think both of those are ultimately important, although without the certification standards in place yet, it's hard to say, but that would be my hope for the future.
Are you hoping that governments will use them with some kind of regulatory framework, or more that it be an educational effort?
Ideally, my personal belief is that if it's a voluntary system that people use and that is it is effective, that is perhaps the best way to do it, although it's hard to know whether we will actually be able to see that come to fruition. So I would say first and foremost, it'd be great if these become voluntary measures, educational measures that are then taken into account as companies and individuals begin producing these biofuels. However, I know there's also discussion about these becoming potential regulatory mechanisms, and those two may be working in concert ultimately.
Are there additional policies that you would recommend for biofuels?
Yes. So first of all, to consider, and some of these we've touched on already, so I hope I don't repeat myself, but some of these are, first of all, to not grow biofuels in native habitats, to not use current agricultural lands that are being used for food stocks, to grow these in areas where perhaps you can be restoring degraded lands. So, for example, planting new forests that you can use the residues for for looking for biofuels, what we are calling sustainable, so require low energy inputs, less water, less fertilizer, less pesticides, and in fact, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. To think about, again, the entire production life cycle. So not just look at when you burn a particular biofuel, whether you're seeing a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, but consider how much energy and how much greenhouse gas emissions are needed to grow that plant, to harvest it, to then transport it to the refinery, to refine it, and then ultimately to burn it inside a vehicle.
You have specific policy advice for Washington State.
Washington State advice, I think, is the same as the advice that I just mentioned for literally the entire world. I don't think there's anything necessarily specific to Washington that would be on top of what I just said, except for the fact that I know cellulosic ethanol and woody biomass is a big issue in Washington. We have a lot of forests. Many of them have many, many trees. We have fire hazards. There's a lot of discussion about trying to thin these forests to reduce catastrophic wildfires. And then there's discussion of whether we can use the biomass that we pull out of these forests to reduce fire hazards to then produce biofuels. And I think that's a fabulous idea. What I would say, though, is that we should learn from the past and make sure we don't repeat the same mistakes for the past and try to be aware of the recommendations that I just mentioned in terms of promoting woody biomass, for example, in this state to produce biofuels.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message is that, first of all, that biofuels are a wonderful potential alternative to helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and reduce our reliance on foreign-based oil. However, we will never solve the carbon dioxide problem solely with biofuels. We just can't do it. What we need to do is, first of all, look at reducing our demands, our energy demands, and then couple that with sustainable, biodiversity-friendly, and climate-friendly biofuels that will actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions over their entire production life cycle. And with that, I think we can actually make a big dent in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and making this planet a healthier planet for all of us to live on today.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Gray, Director of Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Washington. For more information, check on the web at www.nature.org and search for Elizabeth Gray. Again, that's nature.org. You may also call the Nature Conservancy here in Seattle at area code 206-343-4345, extension 338. Again, that's 206-343-4345, extension 338. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM. And KEXP.org.